This event was recorded live as a part of the Cleveland Council on World Affairs Foreign Policy Forum. Ambassador Charles Shapiro joined us to discuss One Step Forward, Two Steps Back, the future of U.S.-Cuba policy. Please visit ccwa.org to learn more about our upcoming speaker series programs.
Hey, good evening, y'all. One of the great things about moving home to Atlanta after 37 years in exile is I've been able to, for 37 years, I had to code switch and talk so that people could understand me in English, and now I'm getting back to my real voice. So I hope y'all will bear with me. And I've been hearing all day long about the differences between East Side and West Side, Cleveland, and which one is better? So we can get into that a little bit later. So One Step Forward, Two Step Backs, the future of U.S.-Cuba policy is what we're gonna, what I'm gonna talk about tonight. Oh, just a moment. Okay, so first of all, how many of you have been to Cuba? I mean, think about that. That is pretty extraordinary out of an audience this size, because up until 2014, it was very difficult. Should I try it now? Okay. It was very difficult to go to Cuba. I mean, you had to meet all kinds of requirements, and then in 2014, it got considerably easier. And to me, it's extraordinary that so many of the people from this audience have been. And I'm sure, you know, each of you that's been there understands it in a very different way, and please correct me where I'm wrong, because you're going to find lots of reasons. Just for those of you who haven't been there, Cuba's got 11 million people. It is the size of Pennsylvania, so if you got that in your mind, but it is elongated. I've got a map right here. Here we go, cool. So it's the size of an appendix, the shape of an appendix. If you put the eastern end on Washington, D.C., the western end would reach to Pittsburgh. Okay, so to give you an idea of how long it is. But here's what you need to know. It's got its total economy. If you add every single bit of it together, is equivalent to the economy of Hartford, Connecticut. Okay? It is Hartford, Connecticut. And I don't mean to put down Hartford, and actually it's metropolitan Hartford, Connecticut, but that's the key thing to keep in mind. So when President Obama announced the opening to Cuba, there were all these people who thought, you know, this is just gonna be great, we're gonna make so much money in Cuba. It's Hartford, Connecticut, and it's a very poor Hartford, Connecticut with 11 million people. Okay, so if we go to the next slide, here we go. So this will give you some idea. And I put the Dominican Republic there as well. Dominican Republic has got more or less the same population. It's got, its economy is bigger, and I bet you not a whole bunch of y'all, unless you're a baseball fan, spends much time talking about the Dominican Republic, right? That's what Cuba ought to be at some point, is that we ought to be talking about Cuba as much as we talk about the DR, right? You think you've got it solved. If you can go to the next one, that would be cool. And here's the problem, is that the Cuban economy is just stuck. And that's not me saying the Cuban economy is stuck. That's Raul Castro, the president of Cuba, saying that the Cuban economy is stuck. Part of it is the U.S. embargo on Cuba. It is illegal, with some exceptions, for U.S. businesses to do business with Cuba. That means shipping stuff to Cuba, buying stuff from Cuba. There are exceptions for food, for agricultural products, and there are exceptions for medical products, broadly defined. I mean, not just medicine, but the things you would use in a hospital, an operating room, all those sorts of things. But total U.S. exports to Cuba is about $300 million a year. That's tiny. Okay, it's going to work now?
Sure.
Oh, a different one. Let's see. This is cool. Here we go. Let's see. Yeah, this is great. Thank you. So here's why. And I'm going to tell you this real quick. Don't take notes, you students. Don't write this down. There won't be a quiz. Okay. So first of all, is that the U.S. embargo hurts Cuba, right? We're the natural market that a small country would trade with. You know, we're Mexico's largest trading partner. We're Canada's largest trading partner. If there were no embargo, we would clearly be Cuba's largest trading partner. So, I mean, just keep that in mind. So the U.S. embargo hurts. But what I'm going to tell y'all is that Cuba really has an embargo on itself. And that embargo is called a communist economic system that doesn't work. Now, they don't have the system that China has. They have the system the Soviet Union had. It didn't work in the Soviet Union, and it doesn't work in Cuba. So almost all business, 75 to 80% of the economy is actually controlled by the state. So that means businesses, factories, hotels, you name it, that are owned by the state. They are hugely inefficient. They got more workers than they need, and they got workers who, in fact, aren't working. I mean, that was the joke in the Soviet Union is they pretend to pay me and I pretend to work. You will hear the same joke in Spanish in Cuba, right? They pretend to pay me, I pretend to work. Because the average salary in Cuba is $32 a month. Not a day, not a week, a month, $32 a month. So they've got tiny foreign exchange reserves. They've got a dual currency system with controlled exchange rates. This is for all you economists and bankers out here. They've got phenomenally low salaries. They've got a population which is literally dropping. So there's 11 million Cubans in Cuba, but the population of Cuba is dropping. Birth rate is lower than the replacement rate, and there's huge outflow of immigrants leaving Cuba, and there is the influx of immigrants going to Cuba is zero. I mean, it's a great place to visit. It's not a place you want to immigrate to, okay? Cuba recognizes it. Raul Castro becomes president in 2008. His brother is sick, Fidel. So the younger brother, Raul, who I think was 83 at the time, that couldn't be right. Now, he must have been in his 70s at the time. My math's bad, because he's 86, 87 now. So the younger brother becomes the president of the country. They have a party congress in 2011 that says, we're going to open the economy. And sure enough, they did. So they made it easier to open little businesses, to open the restaurants that those of you who went to Cuba went to, made it easier for people to rent rooms in their homes. And I'll show you some examples of that later. And what Raul said is the economy is so inefficient, there's over a million workers in the state sector who need to be declared redundant, which is economist talk for fired. And to create jobs for those people, we're going to have the private sector create jobs, and those people will be able to work in the private sector. They open the, if you think of it as a valve, they open the valve a bit, and they open it a little more and a little more, and then in 2016 at the next party congress, the seventh party congress, everybody was this was after United States and Cuba had resumed diplomatic relations, we had a rapprochement, President Obama had visited Cuba, and we had this idea that then the Communist Party was going to further open the economy, and in fact, they did nothing. So they just left things as they were, and it stalled. And in fact, this past summer in August, they said that they shut down some private businesses. They said no more licenses to open new restaurants, no more licenses for people who are renting rooms in their homes. The ones who had it could keep it. And then in July, the first vice president of Cuba, Cuba has five vice presidents, and so the first vice president, who is the guy who will be elected president and sworn in February, in an election with only one candidate, said a number of the people running these private businesses are corrupt, that they're stealing money, and that they are counter-revolutionaries, that they're working against the revolution, which is a serious accusation in a communist country. So that's the dire outlook, but wait, there's more. Hurricane Irma really hit Cuba hard, and particularly hit Havana hard. And so the huge amount of damage from Hurricane Irma. And while all this is going on, Venezuela is going, if you listen to the news, Venezuela is going through a crisis of its own. And so Venezuela has cut back on oil shipments that it was sending Cuba essentially for free. At one point, Venezuela was sending Cuba 125,000 barrels of oil a day. The number varies month to month, but the last number I saw was somewhere between 65,000 and 70,000 barrels of oil a day. And what that means is blackouts in Havana, rolling blackouts in Havana, not the whole city, but different neighborhoods will be without electricity. So now, oh, let me go back. I'm sorry. Did you see this photo? This is the harbor in Havana. Do you see that big old black cloud of smoke coming up? That's from the oil refinery. It was a Gulf oil refinery that was existing in 1959. It is still cutting edge 1959 technology. It has not been upgraded or modernized. So what you see in Havana in the morning is smoke over the city, both from this and from the power plant, which burns fuel oil to generate electricity. Okay, so here we go. So Raul is going to retire, Raul Castro, in February of 2018. The gentleman, Raul's the older guy on the left. The guy on the right is the first vice president. His name is Miguel Diaz Canel. If any of you have ever heard his name before, please raise your hand. There you go. Thank you. That's because he's really not a public figure. He's a loyal party bureaucrat who, since he graduated from university, has worked within the government. He's in his early 50s, which in a country that's been ruled by octogenarians, and I'm closely approaching that. Not that I don't have anything wrong, nothing wrong with octogenarians, but somebody in his 50s, what's that, a quintogenarian? Anyhow, a guy in his 50s is a young man in Cuba. So this is the young guy who's going to take over. Nobody knows much about him because he doesn't give interviews. He doesn't talk to the press. You don't see him on TV. Every now and then you might. But he doesn't have much to say. I've actually talked to Cuba experts who say, well, we think he's more pragmatic because he has a tablet. And when he's an engineer and he goes around with a tablet. That's how we know he's more pragmatic and more modern. Maybe. I mean, that's one possibility. But the other possibility is that he's a retrograde guy who uses a tablet. I mean, the technology he uses doesn't tell you anything about how he's going to run the country. And the reason he's going to be president is they're in the election system now, so that the municipal level elections, I think, have already been held. The whole country is, everywhere in the country, you're inside a municipality. The municipalities have elected people to the municipal assemblies. Then not the voters, but the people in the municipal assemblies, the city councilmen, elect the people to the provincial level assemblies. And then the provincial level assemblies will elect the people to the National Assembly, except for the 50% that are appointed by the Communist Party of Cuba. So this guy will be elected president. So Obama opened U.S.-Cuba policy in 2014, secret negotiations. We agreed to reopen embassies. We had diplomatic staffs in both countries, but we didn't have official diplomatic relations. So I mean, the building is the same building. They just took the sign off that said U.S. Interest Section and put the sign up that said U.S. Embassy, and the Cubans did the same thing on 16th Street in D.C. So, and the guy who was the head of the Interest Section in Havana is now the Cuban ambassador to the United States. When candidate Trump was running for president, he gave speeches and he said he was going to reverse that opening, that he was going to reverse the relaxation of tension between Cuba and the United States. He gets elected and, you know, people kept saying, well, he couldn't possibly do that because he's a business guy. I mean, why would you do that? He owns hotels, you know, doesn't he understand you? He should invest and build hotels there. And instead, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. So in July, I've got it written down here, hopefully I can remember the date. In July of this past summer, 2017, President Trump gives a speech in a theater in Calle Ocho in Little Havana in Miami, and he says, we're going to reverse Obama policy. It was a huge mistake, worst deal the United States has ever made, except for NAFTA and the Iran nuclear deal. But it was a horrible mistake. We're going to reverse it. And then he, in fact, didn't reverse it. I mean, nothing changed in terms of regulations or law. And I got to give you a footnote here, is that most U.S.-Cuba policy is not policy. U.S. policy towards France is policy. The president can change it. The Secretary of State can say we're going to do more of this or less of that. But since 1996, U.S. policy towards Cuba has been enshrined in law, and the president can't change it. Only Congress can change that. So the embargo is law, it's not policy. Okay, so if you want to get rid of the embargo, you got to pass a law. And what Obama did was the things that are within the purview of the president, and that is to establish full diplomatic relations. That the president can do. He nibbled around the edges of the embargo, but he didn't do away with the embargo. Okay, So Trump can reverse that because, again, it's the law is going to stay the same, and he can reverse some of President Obama's measures. So then, let's see, what do I got next? Here we go. So our diplomats get zapped by this sonic weapon, right? The State Department spokesman said last week that it was a total of 24 U.S. diplomats who have been affected by some kind of sonic weapon. That it was a high-pitched sound. It was not in the embassy itself, but it was in their homes and in a hotel where the embassy puts people up when they first come into the country. What she didn't say, the State Department spokeswoman, is she didn't say the Cubans did it. What she said was, it's up to the Cubans to stop this, to figure out what it is and stop it. And so, and that was last week, I think. Actually, you can go to on YouTube, and you can actually, there's a clip of the sound. Yeah. That you can listen, and you know, you tell me, do you think this is, I got no idea. Because what's not been released is any medical examinations, anything by a physician or a scientist that says, this is what happened, this is not what happened. So it's all supposition. And so what State Department is saying is, our diplomats are in danger, we're pulling a whole bunch of them out. So we withdrew them from Havana. We sent home two Cuban diplomats as we withdrew, we declared them persona non grata. I had to think there for a minute. I haven't said that in a long time. Essentially tossed them out of the U.S., sent them home, bam. And State Department issued a travel warning, not a travel advisory. Travel advisory says be careful when you go to Mexico City, stay away from this and that neighborhood. A travel warning is, we are officially warning you as the United States Department of State, do not go to this country. So We issued a travel warning telling Americans, do not go to Cuba, because if you do, you, number one, you might be subject to this sonic weapon. Number two, if something else happens to you while you're there, we don't have the diplomatic staff to get you out of jail, to get you on a medevac flight if you fall ill, to look after the welfare of American citizens in Cuba. All right. So now, I'm going to, all that's kind of grim. What I want to talk about now is what I think is the cool part of Cuba. First of all, it is a beautiful place. Those of you who went there know it's a beautiful place with lovely people who really want to talk to you, you know, are very outgoing and want to make sure that foreigners understand their country. But what I think is the future of Cuba are quintapropistas. Now, you got to understand a little bit about Cuba. Quintapropista, if you are Venezuelan, is a word that doesn't mean anything. It is a Cuban word, it's not a Spanish word. Because Cubans can't call anybody an entrepreneur. It's a communist country. We can't have entrepreneurs, right? We can't say somebody's a business executive. You can't say that. What you can say is that people work on their own account, cuenta propia. Therefore, they are quintapropistas, got it? So this is a Cuban word that means somebody who is self-employed. There's supposed to be 300,000 people who are either self-employed, that is, they run a business themselves, or people work for them, right? And it's legal. Now, I'm not making this up. There are exactly 211 job categories that are legal for the private individuals to enter into in Cuba, 211. They started out, it was 100 and something, and then they increased it, and then they increased it again until they got to 211. I guarantee you, on a work day in Cleveland, within half a mile of where we're sitting, there's probably 1,000 different, 2,000, 5,000 job categories. So this is 211 job categories, most of which are personal services. So it's barbers who had been state employees since 1967. It's beauty salon operators. It's people selling stuff on street corners. It's people making fast food. It's people with restaurants in their homes. And you're going to see. And so that's where the government was hoping that people who are working in factories and state industry inefficiently, that they would go and work and become quintapropistas. And so I'm going to give you some examples of quintapropistas. But this gives you an idea of kind of how high tech they are. This is a guy's repairing shoes. Okay, shoe repair is one of the categories. Automobile repair. This guy, Julio Alvarez, some of you may have met with him. He restores those beautiful 1950 automobiles. Okay? By the way, he only does GM products. He will not touch a Ford. And those of y'all who are old enough, it's just like East Side and West Side in Cleveland, you were either a Ford family or a Chevrolet family, right? And so his dad was a Chevrolet mechanic, and he is only going to work on GM products. He's got, you can't see it, way in the background is a Sears Craftsman metal lathe. Pre-1959, it was his dad's, and it still works. Now, this is important because there are no spare parts in Cuba. Let me say that again. There are no spare parts in Cuba. His supply chain is he's got a guy in Miami who's got a guy in Santa Ana, California, which is apparently the mother load of parts for 1950s General Motor products. He gets them shipped from California to Miami, and they come in suitcases, okay? Because individuals are not allowed to import anything in Cuba. I mean, you can't, you know, FedEx, no. Only the government can import stuff. So he has the parts brought in one at a time. He told me that it takes him 8 months to restore a car if he had a Napa, you know, genuine auto parts place. He could do it in 2 months, right? So that's the cost of being there. That's the inefficiency of being there. Okay, so that's Julio. The woman on the left, I don't want to go into all the stories in great detail. I can if you really want me to. The woman on the left has got three sewing machines in her apartment. She has people who work for her piece work. So you get paid by how many you produce, right, in the worker's paradise. And they're making baby clothes because she says that the baby clothes made in Cuba isn't nice enough. I mean, and she's not selling this to tourists. This is for Cubans. Her supply chain is she flies to Quito, Ecuador, every 6 weeks to 2 months, buys the material and whatever you call the lace ribbons and the stuff that you put on baby clothes, and brings it back. So an empty suitcase is her supply chain. And by the way, she's doing well. I mean, she sold her old apartment. She and her husband and two children moved to a new apartment. She was a former architect. She and her husband redid their apartment themselves, and it's terrific. The woman on the right is the wife of the guy restoring automobiles. She's got a car service, right? So those of y'all who went to Cuba, you can call her, get online, and you can actually, they'll pick you up in the car and take you around for a day and give you the tour, the whole thing. Here's the deal. You're only allowed to have one car. They've got 22. Because, you know, one's in her name, one's in the husband's name, one's in the cousin's name, one's the brother-in-law's name. They got 22 cars on the road in their cars. It's great, good for them. And this is her favorite, the pink one. That's hers. She actually runs she's the business brain. The husband restores cars. She makes the business work. This guy is doing an app. He's essentially doing, you know, what's going on in Havana app, where are the restaurants, what's on at museums, what exhibits are going on. It's free for Cubans, but if you're a foreigner, you have to pay to download it, right? So they try to get you to download it ahead of time before you get there. These guys, some of y'all who went there may have met with them. These are people who give lectures to foreigners. So when you come in on your tour, right, and people are talking to you, they're getting paid. I mean, we pay them $150 to talk to us. And so that's $150 for an hour and a half lecture in a country where people are making $32 a month makes these guys wealthy, right? So the guy on the left in the red shirt is a retired Cuban diplomat. And I've crossed swords with him a number of times. A retired Cuban diplomat who teaches at their diplomatic academy, and he lectures mainly American tourists about how dumb the United States is. The guy on the right is an economist at the University of Havana, who is in the really weird, for those of you who are economists or bankers, I mean, economists work on facts, right? Numbers, data. And so to be a communist economist is almost a contradiction in terms. And he said, well, this is what's going on. Here's how it works. We've given our advice to the Cuban government. I'm on the committee for blah, 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 blah. Do they listen to your advice? No, they don't take his advice. And so I'll keep going and I'll speed it up. Street performers, there's loads of them. The guy on the left is actually very funny, by the way. He's in the right by the main square by the cathedral. The guy on the right, his name is Alexei. He's half of a hip-hop duo called Obsession. And who knew that hip-hop was huge in Cuba? Hip-hop is huge in Cuba. And so they put out music, put out CDs. They're making money that way. On the left is these... Papito is the name of the guy, by the way, the big guy on the left. The African-American guy sitting in the barber chair is the mayor of Atlanta, Kasim Reed, who I took to Cuba with me. And what Papito does is he got an old barber shop, and it's got the only barber museum in the world. He's got tons of old hair dryers and razors and clippers and stuff, but what he really is a beauty parlor. And he runs a school for To train beauty parlor operators. What's the word for beauty parlor operators? There's a better word for that. Salon cosmologist. He trains cosmologists. Cosmetologist? Is that what it's called? Yeah, cosmologist is someone's planets, right? He's donated money and time to his neighborhood. He goes to a retirement, an old folks like daycare center that's near him, and he does the hair for the people in the old folks home. Interestingly, he runs a course for girls from a school for the deaf, teaching them cosmetology for free. Doesn't charge for that. The two people on the right, in many ways, are the most interesting. The woman on the with the dark top runs one of the super successful restaurants. They're called Paladares in Cuban Spanish. And it's called L'Atelier. If any of you ate there, I mean, it is just fabulous. She's great. You're only allowed to have one restaurant. You can only feed so many people per day at your restaurant. She's got a second restaurant because it's her brother-in-law. Or, you know, it's one of these funky things that she's got going. She is like the Lee Iacocca of Paladar business. For those of you who can remember Lee Iacocca, the woman with the light colored top runs an event planning business. So there you go. Do you run a so? What she does, do y'all know what a quinceañera is? Do y'all have those in, yes. It's a party that everywhere in Latin America, girls have this party when they turn 15. She helps put on birthday parties, quinceañeras, the parties for 15-year-olds. If your Uncle Jaime is visiting from Miami, you know, and you want to put on a big deal for them, people will get married. She does all that. She's got not full-time employees, but she's got clowns for the birthday party. She's got the videographer. She's got the people that rent the dresses for the quinceañera. And she's making money. She's an economist from the University of Havana who quit to do this. She said her colleagues told her she was crazy. How could you quit working at the most prestigious university in the country to put on parties? And she says, now they're calling her and asking for jobs, okay? Her supply chain, she's got a U.S. visa. Her supply chain is she flies to Miami once a month with an empty suitcase and goes to, guess where, Party City. Fills it up and comes back. Party City, there you go. So, I mean, there's a whole bunch of these folks. These guys are artists. The guy is the painter. The wife is the sculptor. I don't understand her sculpture, but it's very cool. And farmers. These are tobacco farms in the far west of the country. You can't own land in Cuba if you're a farmer. But what you can do is, and there's a word, I'm going to tell you a word in English, and except for very old lawyers, none of you are going to know. It's called usufruct. Yeah. Who's the old lawyer? Okay, you're the old lawyer. Okay, it means you have the use of the land for a given amount of time, but you don't own the land. Okay, you have the use of the land, but you don't own the land. Usually it's like for 50 years. And you have to give a certain amount of your crop, you have to sell it to the state, but then the rest you can sell yourself. And so that's how they're trying to get more people to, in this case, raise more tobacco. And the guy on the right, he loves it because he says, "Man, I'm on the tourist trail." So they come here and I'm selling them cigars. So anyhow, he loves it. Okay, so that's what's going on in Cuba. I mean, that's what's going on in Cuba. Here's what's not going on is change. So when you're there and you meet with government officials, what you will find, I mean, they are wrestling with how to go forward. They know that their economy doesn't work, that their children are leaving the country as soon as they graduate from university, but they also want to ensure that they've got relative social equality in the country. The difference between the richest and the poorest is fairly small. In a country that was very divided racially, you know, you get into university, you get into medical school based on your scores, not on who your parents were, or what your last name is, or what part of the country you're from. They want to maintain that. Education in Cuba is free for the student. Not for the government, obviously, but for the student from kindergarten through graduate school, if you can get into graduate school. I mean, it's competitive. Not everybody can go to medical school. I mean, you have to get in. They want to maintain that. Healthcare in Cuba is free for the patient, not for the government, right? Because they've got to run the hospitals, pay the doctors, do all that kind of stuff. So they want to maintain free education, maintain free medical care, maintain social equality, but make the economy grow. And that's what they're wrestling with. And the best analogy that I have been able to come up with is I can remember when I was 10 years old and I went to the neighborhood swimming pool, Garden Hill swimming pool, with my brother, and he made me go up the high dive. And I got up there and I looked down and I knew I was not going to jump off that thing. And my older brother told me he would beat me up if I didn't, right? So you're stuck with, do I jump off and get killed, or do I go back down the ladder and get killed, right? That's what Cuba is faced with right now. Do they open the economy? Do they follow? I have to tell you, every American business person whom I have taken to Cuba, ask the Cubans with complete sincerity, well, of course you're going to follow the Chinese model. Look how well China has done. And the Cubans say, no. No, we didn't have this revolution to sell it out the way the Chinese have. Right? Well, then what about the Vietnamese model? Nope, nope, nope. I mean, it's like, backsliders in the Baptist church, right? These are backsliders. And so they're stuck with, how do we keep the system? How do we make the economy grow? And how do we maintain the role of the Communist Party in running the country? And how do we maintain the benefits of the revolution, healthcare, education, and equality? And they can't figure out how to square that circle. So I got one last slide. This is for those of you who are business people. We export $300 million a year to Cuba. We export to Canada $267 billion a year. We export to Canada in 9 hours what we export to Cuba in a year, right? I mean, it's just like, that's where, if you want to make money, invest in Canada. Or actually, invest in Colombia. So, and I got one, so here's the ad for me. Y'all want to go to Cuba? Come with me. Okay, so I got a trip to Cuba in February. Spend Valentine's Day in Cuba. You'll meet the people in those photos. All those photos, by the way, were taken from people who traveled with me. And then I'm going to go to Colombia March 10th through 17th, and I'm going to tell you this. Colombia is fabulous. It is. Those of y'all who've been to Cuba, go to Colombia. It is fabulouser than Cuba is. I'm going to stop there. I'm going to answer questions. Thank you very much. This is where you're supposed to applaud. Ambassador Hodges told me short answers.
Question, we're scheduled to go to Cuba December 26th with daughter, husband, 17-year-old, and a 20-year-old. Should we go? We have a New York travel agent that says no problem. And that's why we're here tonight, to get some guidance.
It is not illegal to go. You will be breaking no U.S. law if you go. If you run into severe problems in Cuba, you may have difficulties because the embassy is short-staffed now. You have to make that decision about whether you want to go or not. There you go.
Just go.
Actually, I would go. Look, I'm going in February. So what I'm hoping is by February all this gets sorted out. Okay, yes, sir, right here. Or you get to choose or I choose.
You can help.
Okay. You choose. Okay.
Thank you very much for a very interesting, fascinating insight on Cuba. The Brits have had a fascination with Cuba over the years. And I know that has annoyed Americans a lot. And I'm not talking left-wing, Labourite, socialist Brits. It's industrialist, Thatcherite, conservative Brits who've had this love affair with Cuba for many years. It's a bit
What did you get out of it?
I'm sorry?
What did the UK get out of it?
Well, they like the cars, and they like the people, and the countryside, I guess. But it is a bit bizarre. Thatcherite Britain's loving socialist Cuba. It's like students who wear Che Guevara T-shirts. But and when the opportunity arose for Americans or people who live in America to go to Cuba directly, that sounded like a wonderful thing. And CCWA had a visit from a Cuban who actually came to our house for a meal. And obviously the people would love visitors, but the dilemma I want to ask you is, what are the ethics of that? If you take your trips and tourists go to Cuba, how much does that actually benefit ordinary people, and how much of the income goes straight into the pockets of the Castros and the other nasty people run Cuba?
That's a great question. I'm going to give the short answer, okay, because Heather instructed me to be a man of few words. Look, if you go to China, if you go to other dictatorships around the world, essentially you're doing the same thing. So what we're gonna do when we go is we're gonna stay in private homes so that the money goes to individuals, not to the hotels, right? But when you stay in homes, the person who's renting the room has to get a license, has to pay for it, has to pay a tax. Somebody, if I've got one room and I rented out 20 nights this month, I've got to pay 20 nights worth of tax. If I serve breakfast in the morning, there's a tax on that. You see what I'm saying? So it's going to the state. The other thing that is just hugely complicated to parse out, and I think that's one reason why, to be fair to the Trump administration, they have been so long in issuing the regulations, is that a huge amount of the Cuban economy is actually run by the Ministry of Defense. So that the money isn't, it's not only going to the welfare fund, it's going to the army, right? And so I think what they're trying to do is say, well, this hotel, this, that, this, the other, and to put them off limits, because the Trump administration doesn't want you or me going and staying in a hotel that's owned by the Ministry of Defense. And so I think part of what they're trying to do is figure out what do they own and what do they not own, right? So the answer is, of course you're helping the state, but you're also helping the quintapropistas. If you go and you eat in private restaurants, if you stay in private homes, if you buy things from artists, and I mean not just whether it's fine art or it's craft art, you're helping the people who've made that stuff, right? You need to talk to your priest or rabbi to figure out whether it's moral.
I just want to thank you so much for your time and coming us. So I'm speaking on behalf of Montessori High School. Model UN group, and I was wondering and really fascinated with your topic of discussion in reference to communism and the economy, very well discussed, and I was wondering, in the educational system of Cuba, what is the relationship between communism and their education, if you could elaborate.
From day one to the day you graduate, that's the relation. I mean, there's no local textbooks. I mean, all textbooks come from the Ministry of Education, and the purpose of all textbooks is to tell people that communism is a great way to run a country. So it's embedded from day one to the very end. I mean, at the graduate school level, at medical school, I mean, they will download studies from Cleveland Clinic or wherever it is. I don't want to say there's no influence; that would be wrong. But no, I mean, from the primary school textbooks are all written by them, and they're I got it. Those of you who are as old as me, I mean, one of the things that my answer is going too long, I apologize, is that what I find is that people over 40 who go on these trips with me really don't understand what communism is. I mean, if you think about it, how lucky they are that they went to university after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Those of us who are older, when we went to university, both in our political science classes and our economics classes, you know, our enemy was the Soviet Union, and we needed to understand how the Soviet Union worked, and so we all studied it. I have people who go with me to Cuba, and they'll go, well, this just makes no sense. This is crazy. Why, you know, why is the state distributing toilet paper? You know, why, you know, it's not like you're running the electric system fine, but why is the government deciding how many rolls of toilet paper get delivered to each store rather than, you know, CVS is running out and needs more and orders it 2 weeks in advance and the truck, you know, it's like, anyhow, it's just, the people going to me really don't understand communism. So I hope at the Montessori school, I hope y'all take a look, figure it out.
Just wanted to know, if you were in charge, what would be your the policy that we should have towards Cuba from here on?
Yeah, okay, here, look, we've got difficult, intractable, thank you, problems all over the world. And Cuba's one of them, right? But here's what I think, and this is being podcast, so I guess I better say it correctly, is having full diplomatic relations with countries around the world ought to be the default position, including with Cuba. Particularly with countries that you have problems with, you want to have diplomatic relations. You want to have a Cuban ambassador in Washington and a US ambassador in Havana, or a Chinese ambassador in Washington, or a Russian ambassador in Washington. I'm not so sure about North Korea, by the way. So that they get the message straight, so there's no misunderstanding. So when you tell them they're a jerk and here's the three reasons why, they know it comes from the President of the United States. Or so when they call us the jerks and here's the three reasons why, we know it comes from the President of Cuba. When relations are tough, that's when you want to make sure there's no misunderstandings. I mean, we have relations with Burma, right? My gosh. I mean, we have relations with human rights violators and crummy governments all over the world. Having diplomatic relations doesn't mean you like them. It means you've got an ambassador there confirmed by the United States Senate who is the personal representative of the President of the United States and can speak on behalf of the President. Bam. Punto final. You like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
This was a Heather Hodges approved answer.
Thank you very much. You said that Raul opened the valve a little bit for people to a little more entrepreneurship, and then you said he sort of stopped and closed a little bit. My question is, do you think that there was any influence because of that from Putin? And also, have you heard the rumors that the Sonic thing could also have been generated from Russia rather than Cuba?
Okay, I have no idea how much influence Putin has to give directions to Raul Castro. And frankly, I doubt that if he did, Raul Castro would take them. Okay, with all due respect, if any of you are Cuban Americans, I mean, Cubans are pretty proud people, whether they're in the United States or in Cuba, right? And they have a very strong sense of who they are and of their country. They don't tend to take direction well from other countries. I think it's part of their national characteristic. So are they taking directions from Putin? I don't know. I don't think so. As to the Sonic thingy, are the Russians behind it? It could be. I just don't know. But I do know this. And so this is the troubling part, to go back to this gentleman's question, is make no mistake, Cuba is a police state. I mean, there are police everywhere. A lot of them aren't armed, by the way, but there are police everywhere. They're tapping phones. They're listening to stuff. I mean, that one of the things that I find troubling is if they didn't do it, how is it that? And in fact, this is what the Bush administration, try again, the Trump administration is saying, is if they didn't do it, how come they don't know? I mean, it's almost inconceivable that they don't know, right? Because we've been very careful to say it wasn't the Cubans who did it, but it's the Cubans' responsibility to find out who it was. Yeah.
The title of this lecture, I think, was Cuba One Step Forward, Two Steps Back. And I'm not sure if you were referring to Cuba moving one step forward and two steps back, or whether that referred to our U.S. position.
Oh, that's so cool. that's a great question. The short answer is both. So what I think Trump did, and I think it's very smart, is rather than undoing the advances, the rapprochement that President Obama made, he's just saying, we got this sonic thing, they're attacking our diplomats. If you think about it, it's like a backdoor way to change the policy without changing the policy. That's the step back. Okay, and for the Cubans, it's the getting up to the edge of the diving board and then backing off. And so what they actually did this summer, I mean, and this guy Miguel Diaz-Canel, what he said is these people are, some of them are cheating on their taxes, they're breaking regulations, they have multiple restaurants when they're only supposed to have one, they have multiple cars when they're only supposed to have one. And they're counter-revolutionaries. Well, they are in a semantic sense. I mean, because we know that small business people are the most independent people in the world, right? They make their money because of what they do and their own efforts. So, in a sense, I don't want to say counter-revolutionary in the sense they're trying to overthrow the government, but they become almost where the government becomes irrelevant. And in a communist system, that's terrible for the government. So I'll tell you an anecdote, and I apologize, Heather. So this friend of mine who works with the company that we help, that helps arrange our trip, so she's 24, 25 years old, smart young woman, and she moved from Cienfuegos to Havana, Cienfuegos on the southern coast. And all Cubans have a ration book. You know, just like we did during the Second World War, Cubans have a ration book. And when you move, one way that they control where you live is you have to go to get your ration book changed from Cienfuegos to Havana. And she says, I never bothered to do it because I'd have to wait in line. It would kill a whole bunch of my time. And I'm making enough money, I don't need the ration book. Right? She has just become free of the state. I not in an insidious way, not in a revolutionary way, but she's just free. She can make her own decisions for herself. She doesn't have to go to the march on the Plaza de la Revolución. She doesn't have to go, she doesn't have to do that stuff because, and you know what she doesn't have to do? She doesn't have to go to the meetings of every neighborhood and every building has got a committee for the defense of the revolution. That, you've got to go once a month or whatever it is and read, the latest things from the Communist Party. She doesn't have to go to that because she doesn't care. Because she doesn't care if they take away her ration book because she's not using it. And so to answer your question, sir, that's what we ought to be encouraging in Cuba. Is small businesses, people who are starting businesses, prospering and failing in their businesses as well, but who, through their own actions, earn the money that they make. Right? That's counter-revolutionary. Earn the money that they make so they can make their own decisions about their own lives, and I don't need the ration book. There you go. That's my sermon for the night.
I get the last one.
Oh, man.
Señor embajador.
That's me editing you.
Are you cutting me out?
Yeah.
Is it on? Okay. You know, most people here.
Well, hold it closer and don't wave it around.
Okay, you know, but most people here don't know that I was born and raised in Venezuela. So I look at Cuba from a different direction. And Cuba has always depended on other countries to survive. It was Russia, and then afterwards Venezuela with the oil. But Cuba is very involved in Latin America. They were very involved in the negotiations that legalized the FARC in Colombia. And they have about 100,000 men in Venezuela right now. Most of them armed, some like doctors. But I don't want to take your presentation off into a different direction because it could go in a different direction.
You just have.
But generally, what is Cuba's role and strategy vis-a-vis the neighboring Latin American countries? Because it's not a standalone island.
No. Okay, so that's, you know, here's the 30-minute answer to a three-minute question, and I'm going to apologize because I don't want to bore all of y'all. But what has happened is, I think I said Cuba at one point was providing 125,000 barrels a day of oil to Cuba. It's less than that now. In return, Cuba was providing, in public, for public consumption, basketball coaches and doctors and dentists and medical personnel. They also were providing intel personnel and political advisors to Venezuela. So that this guy was here, the guy giving the lectures in the red shirt. You know, he says, you know, we've got an advisor in every Chavista pro-government of Venezuela state governorship has got a Cuba political advisor who's working with them. You know, their intel people are working with Venezuelan intel. The Cubans actually run the Venezuelan identity card system. I mean, you know, like your driver's license and social security card. It's actually Cubans in the office who issue your Venezuelan driver's license, your Venezuelan ID card is issued by a Cuban, right? And just think about what data you have there. I mean, just extraordinary data. So I know there are calls back and forth. I mean, you saw in the news, Maduro was in Havana, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. They're consulting back and forth. How much do they listen? I don't know. I mean, I do find it ironic that Raul Castro declared the governor's election of October 15th to be free and fair. You know, because he's an expert on democratic elections, right? So, anyhow, I mean, it is a relationship which is troubling at the very least. You know, that Cuban ballet instructors are teaching Venezuelans to dance. Fine, you know, that the woman who worked in my house had a doctor in her neighborhood that she could take her mom to when her mom's asthma acted up. Fine, I guess. But it's the political relationship that is troubling. And I have been retired now for 6 years. And I don't see all those reports that detail all that information, so I can't really answer your question any more fully than that. Anyhow, thank you all very much.